right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Crypto 101 podcast. I'm your co-host, Bryce, as always, joined by my good buddy, Mr. Brendan Veman. Brendan, how are you doing, my man?
Bryce, I'm doing good. It's a great time to be in crypto. And, you know, we've had a lot of requests for this very project. I've seen the chatter in the community, so I think everyone's going to be really excited for what we got in store.
Yeah, this is a really exciting episode. We're bringing on the co-founder of Say Labs, Jay Jogue. Jay, how are you doing today?
Life is good, guys. It's been past few months have been incredible. I would say chaotic in many ways, but things are good. And thank you so much for having me on, guys.
Awesome. Yeah, chaotic. I hope, like you said, in a good way. Hopefully with the business and with growing, but everything personally, two thumbs up. You had a good holiday and all that?
Oh yeah, holidays are great. I'm actually in SF right now, and I haven't been in SF for a while. And it's crazy just to see how the city is coming back to life right now. So yeah, I've been a past week as well over here.
That's really good to hear. Yeah, things have been pretty dismal over there for the past couple of years, which is sad because it used to be such a bright light, a beacon of hope. And it's good to hear the boots on the ground. You're over there. Things are looking brighter.
We actually got started with Say back in SF. And I think at that time it was kind of reaching its like peak of autumn. So I remember 2021, it was kind of nice. And then it just progressively became worse and worse. So nice to be back here in a way.
Yeah. Was that when you were at Robinhood in San Francisco? Because I seem to remember you and your co-founders got your start. Tell us a little bit about the genesis of Say Labs and everything you guys got going on here.
100%, guys. Yeah. So my story is that I grew up in the Bay Area. I lived in different parts of the South Bay, East Bay, and then I ended up going down to college in LA. So I've been basically in California most of my life. I ended up meeting my co-founder through speech and debate back in high school. Did you guys used to do debate at all?
I didn't do speech and debate. I did like comedy and like improv and stuff, though, believe it or not.
Yeah, that's a lot cooler. That's a lot less nerdy than debate was. But yeah, like that's how I met him. We went to competing high schools, and I've known him since, I guess this is when I was 14. So it's been around 14 years now, I guess. Yeah. Crazy that I've known him at least for half my life.
Wow.
But yeah, since then, I went down to college to study computer science. Afterwards, I ended up, I guess there's like the story of how I got into crypto, and then there's a story for how we started Say.
Yeah, I love both, actually.
Yeah. So I initially got into crypto back in the 2017 bull run. So I was graduating college 2018, but my friends, they were graduating 2017, and a lot of them were joining Facebook at the time. So for anyone that might not really be as familiar, like these Silicon Valley companies, they tend to give potentially large signing bonuses to anyone that is a new hire that's joining full time. So my friends, they were getting $100,000 signing bonuses for joining Facebook back then. And I mean, they give a big chunk of it right when you sign. So I think it's like 50, 60K you get immediately when you sign the offer letter. So they had this money. They're like, what should we do with it? Well, given that they were like these 21, 22 year old kids, they're like, okay, let's just dump it all into Ether. And they dumped it all into Ether when it was like $40 a token, which I mean, it was incredible to, looking back at it, it's incredible foresight that they had. I think back then I just thought that they were gambling addicts. And I mean, potentially both of those were true. But yeah, they dumped it all into Ether. And then they just, I mean, everything started picking up back then, right? So I saw them write it up. They then decided to start like trading alts. And if there's anything that I guess you can learn from that is don't start trading alts if you don't really know what you're doing over there. So in their case, they ended up losing all of the gains they had. They ended up breaking even. I think they learned some life lessons from that. I was watching them learn some life lessons from that. And that's kind of how I initially got exposed to crypto. Afterwards, I graduated. I was working full time at Robinhood. And at that time, I was living in Menlo Park. So Menlo Park is right next to Palo Alto, really close to Stanford campus. And my roommate at the time, he was one of my friends from my last internship. He was getting his master's from Stanford. And he was starting a crypto company. It was actually going through Binance Labs at the time. So I was like, oh shit, you're doing this cool stuff. I want to learn more about it. And that's how I got exposed to smart contract development and like actually learning about the technical parts of crypto. Because I mean, 2017, I didn't really understand what a consensus algorithm was. I just knew what tokens were and like where you could buy them. 2018, I learned a lot more about like, oh, these are the different consensus mechanisms. This is how a smart contract works, like all that kind of stuff, right? And then afterwards, I like that's my kind of intro to learning about the technical side of crypto. I spent a few years at Robinhood after that, around 3.5 years in total. And I joined as an engineer, so a new grad software engineer, eventually became an engineering lead over there. And it was wild to see the company scale. Like when I initially interviewed for Robinhood, it was two houses across the street from each other in Palo Alto. In one of the houses, they literally took the bedrooms of that house. They put standing desks over there, and that's where the engineers would work from. So it was like very scrappy when I initially met the team.
It reminds me of like the Silicon Valley TV show.
Exactly. Yeah. Like I feel like all these great companies get started from like these really scrappy kind of initial garages or like bedrooms, whatever. I think in many ways, Robinhood was quite similar over there. And I think their story before they had the entire GameStop saga was just, there were so many interesting tidbits to that story, like how they got started. They initially weren't even working on a trading app. Like they were doing something entirely unrelated and they just ended up getting really lucky from Hacker News with that. But anyway, so yeah, I mean, I worked at Robinhood and I was there when the GameStop saga happened. So for anyone that might be a listener that doesn't remember, in 2021, there were, I want to say around a dozen meme stocks that people on Wall Street Bets, which is a subreddit, just became extremely enthusiastic about. So these meme stocks, they were basically, people are buying them without really thinking about the fundamentals. So these meme stocks, they just kind of started shooting straight to the moon. And a lot of like sophisticated hedge funds are like, this makes literally no sense. The fundamentals over here don't make any sense. So we're going to start shorting it. And shorting is like when you're betting against the market, you think the price is going to go down on that asset. And mechanically, when you're actually shorting an asset, you need to borrow that asset from someone. Then you need to sell the asset. And then when you're closing the position, you need to buy the asset back and then return it to whoever that person is. So when you actually close a short, you need to buy the asset. And what this means is if the price starts going up a lot and someone needs to close their short position because they've lost a lot of money, they then need to buy the asset, which leads to the price going up even more, which causes this phenomenon called a short squeeze. So that makes the price go up even more. So it was just like really incredible moment back then, 2021, where these meme stocks were doing really well. Hedge funds were losing a lot of money on it. And then just out of the blue, Robinhood turned off buys, right? Like there's one day, I think it was like January 28th, Robinhood's people woke up. They're like, oh shit, I cannot buy GameStop anymore. I cannot buy, I think BlackBerry was another one of these meme stocks. Like you can't buy any of these anymore. The entire world was just super upset about that decision. And as an insider, like you feel super shafted when something like that happens, because before then you're like kind of representing Robinhood to all of your friends. You're like kind of bragging about it in a way like, oh, look at this cool company that I work at.
For sure.
And then when things go to shit, it's like, okay, well, I didn't really do anything around that. Like, I don't know how they made that decision, but my friends were getting mad at me. Like people that I actually hadn't talked to for like 2 to 3 years were DMing me. Like one guy, I had an intern.
Turn
with
the buy
like
button
20...
back on. You're an engineer. You could do it just for my account. Turn it back on.
Exactly. Like 2015, I interned with this guy. I hadn't chatted with him for like, at that time, 6 years. And he hit me up again. He's like, yo, bro, what the hell is happening inside Robinhood? Wow. And yeah, I mean, it just feels, you just feel so powerless when something like that happens, right? Like your reputation on the line and then you can't do anything to change it. So that was the kind of initial inspiration for us to be like, okay, this system where everything is super opaque, nothing's transparent, we have no idea what's happening behind the scenes. We don't think that this is the way that things should work. And that was the kind of inspiration for us to start building something like Robinhood, except building it on chain. So that's how we initially got started with this entire journey. And I'll pause over there for you guys to ask other questions.
The mission is the boss, and it cuts across the whole company. By organizing that way, we also created transparency. All these silos became porous. And when organizations are porous, it tends to be better.
If you're like me, you've always had the curiosity and fascination with technology and the minds behind it that are actively shaping our future. Arm is one of those innovative tech leaders, and they're partnering with NPM to bring you a new podcast that takes you behind the boardroom door with technology's most inspiring leaders. Tech Unheard is a podcast series that lets you listen in on one-on-one conversations with industry leaders as they discuss everything from the potential of artificial general intelligence to keynote nerves. Hosted by Arm CEO Renee Haas, Tech Unheard explores the drivers behind each leader's path and analyzes the most pressing trends in their space, all while sharing a few entertaining anecdotes of success and failure along the way. Tech Unheard makes you feel like you're in the room with some of tech's biggest leaders as they engage and inspire in a totally unscripted way. Tune in to Tech Unheard from Arm and NPM wherever you get your podcasts.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, you know, the cool part about that story, in a way, is the fact that that can't happen in crypto. You know, you can't have someone come in and say, nope, you're not going to access your account. You're not going to be able to trade this. That's the cool part about decentralization and self-ownership, is that you're always going to be able to log into your wallet, you know, assuming that you have the keys and you actually control the thing. You're always going to have the option to have access to those funds, you know, deposit, withdraw, trade, connect it to a decentralized exchange, and do as you see fit. And, you know, maybe that's kind of what you're getting at here. I don't want to spoil the story, but, you know, that was a real turning point for a lot of people. And they kind of witnessed that for the first time, being like, hey, I'm really not in control. And just because my money is in this account, you know, I'm really not the person in complete control of my money at the end of the day.
Exactly. I think there's just so many things that can go wrong with decentralized systems. Like, if a bank wants to prevent you from accessing your money, they can. Like, it's your money. It's your life. Like, hours from your life, you work to earn that money, but you cannot access it because they decided not to let you. I think it's like, it really takes away power from you to be able to have agency over your own life. You're like extremely dependent on other people. And yeah, I mean, if Robinhood had been built on these transparent crypto rails, there would have been several steps that would have made the kind of outcome that we saw impossible. Like, one issue that went wrong over there is there were capital requirements that Robinhood had with these third parties, and no one really knew about these. If this had been built on chain, then you would have seen the dependencies just on, like, on the Block Explorer. You would have been able to, like, audit the smart contract yourself. You would have seen that, okay, this is happening because these third parties are requesting more collateral. And then in terms of decision-making, there would have been a DAO, so you would have been able to see how decisions were reached from the DAO in order to, like, turn off buys or something. So I think there would have been a lot more transparency, and it would have just been a much better outcome overall.
And with you know, with this whole self ownership, you know, obviously of our money, that's the first obvious sort of use case. And then we kind of had, you know, all these smart contract platforms, which then extend it to your own personal online data, your healthcare data, you know, your personal information, and kind of, you know, whoever controls the private keys to that could kind of access that. Do you see, and kind of where I'm going with this is, like, do you see Say Network now evolving beyond just sort of a decentralized Robinhood, right? A decentralized trading platform, and some of these use cases expanding to more generalized use cases outside of trading?
Yeah, 100%. And I think we've actually seen this happen over the past couple of years already. At this point, Say is a fully general purpose blockchain. And one of the biggest sources of activity right now on Say is gaming. It's not even tied to financial use cases or trading. It's just people building games. And that's leading to a lot of network activity.
That's cool.
So I think anything that can benefit from having a performant blockchain makes a lot of sense to build on Say. And we can dive into Say as well.
Yeah, and I'm just curious, is it like, is Say an EVM sort of compatible chain, or is it its own thing?
Yeah. So I guess the one-liner for Say is we're the first parallelized EVM blockchain. So it is EVM compatible, and it's also entirely its own thing. So you can think of it like Solana, except supporting the EVM. In terms of how we got started with this, I mean, initially, as I said, we're trying to build a decentralized Robinhood. This led us down this entire journey where, like, okay, let's try building an on-chain order book-based exchange. And then we realized, just back in 2021, realized, wait a minute, this is not possible to build anywhere. There wasn't really any chain that would adequately support this. For example, if you looked at Serum on Solana at the time, Serum was like the Alameda created order book exchange. It was super clunky and there were a ton of limitations on that. And outside of that, there really wasn't anything that even came close to being a usable on-chain order book based exchange. So we're like, okay, let's build our own chain. And then we went through this kind of learning process where we were like, okay, building a chain that only supports one application doesn't really make much sense. Let's build a general purpose chain. So we went live on mainnet with Savvy One, which was a general purpose Cosm Wasm based chain. So Cosm Wasm is similar to how the EVM, the Ethereum Virtual Machine, is an execution environment that Ethereum created. There's other ones. One of them is called Cosm Wasm. And the chain that actually had the most success with Cosm Wasm is Terra. And for anyone that might not remember from 2022, Terra was one of the biggest blockchains in existence at the time. And then it just completely imploded. I think there was like $50 billion of value that was lost in like a couple of week time frame. So yeah. In hindsight, after Terra collapsed, supporting the EVM or supporting Cosm Wasm didn't make as much sense because you would have to kind of bootstrap the developer community yourself. And that's probably the biggest issue we ran into. Like, no one was building on Savvy One when we went live on mainnet. What ended up happening is the chain was live. There was some excitement about the project, but developers weren't really coming because crypto native developers are basically all EVM developers. Mm-hmm. And that's when we built up our core thesis. Kind of after going through that entire episode, we realized one core thing, which is that the EVM is here to stay. Like, regardless of what we've seen happening in the past few years with Solana, Sui, all these like alt VM based chains that have started getting at least more price action and some activity in terms of killer apps on chain. Most developers are still EVM developers. There's that report from Electric Capital earlier this year where they're like around 70 to 80% of crypto native developers are still EVM developers, which I think speaks volumes about how it's really difficult to get people to move off the EVM because it's not just an execution environment. It's also much more than that. It's like an entire ecosystem. It's all the tooling, the developers, the mindshare, everything that's already been built around that. So that was kind of when we realized, okay, we need to be supporting the EVM. And that led us down the entire kind of discovery journey for deciding what to build after that.
Yeah, that's interesting. And, you know, one of the questions I kind of had queued up that I was going to ask you, but you might have just answered it, was kind of like, what was the most challenging thing launching your new L1? And maybe it was, you know, finding out that everybody's just an EVM developer and so kind of catering to that. But was there anything that was surprising or challenging along the way?
There have been so many just excruciatingly difficult parts of this journey. I think so. There's stuff tied to like fundraising that I think has just been extremely difficult for us because we just started to raise money at all the wrong times. The first time we raised was the end of May 2022. If you guys recall, Terra Luna collapsed start of May 2022.
Yeah, Three Arrows Capital was collapsing in May of 2022.
Exactly. Like, we started raising right after the collapse, which in hindsight was a terrible idea because everyone just starts kind of, investors just want to sit on the sideline. Like, they want to see how things cool off and then they want to start deploying capital because it's just risky to be deploying when prices could fall another 50% like 2 weeks from then.
Totally.
So our seed round was, it was tough. We ended up getting Multicoin Capital to lead the round, which, I mean, we got extremely lucky over there. I mean, Multicoin, they're primary fund behind Solana. So I think they've had a ton of experience that has been helpful for us. But I think we would have had a very different outcome if Multicoin had decided to not really get involved with Say. And then afterwards, our second round, we initially tried raising 2 days before FTX collapsed. Like, we started having initial conversations at the time. This was November of 2022. 2 days after that, FTX collapsed. We're like, oh shit, this is such a terrible time to be raising because FTX collapsed and then it's the holidays afterwards. So I think fundraising has been consistently one of the harder parts for us. I think the second bigger low point was exactly what you were mentioning before, which is we launched mainnet and then no one was using it. And I don't know, it just really sucks as a founder when like you put your all into something and then people don't really care. Like, if people feel negatively about something, that actually in a way is better than just being irrelevant. And I think that's one of the hardest things in crypto. Like, how do you maintain relevance for any project after it's gone live on mainnet and especially after the token has been launched? So that's when we really needed to think about from a first principle standpoint, like, why is no one using Say? What can we do to help better facilitate the ecosystem there? And that kind of led us down this journey of Save E2.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of groups that try to launch layer ones run into that issue. And it's hard, right? I mean, you're fighting against some of these larger protocols, these legacy projects that have kind of founded layer ones. And it's hard to steal market share away from them. But, you know, what we've really seen is a huge advancement when it comes to layer ones. Like the ones that we're creating today, you know, even Say is, you know, numerous times more advanced than Ethereum, you know, especially when it was created. And so what we've started to see is this kind of adoption or this change in how people are using them and all the use cases. And so, you know, my question here is, you know, how do you see layer ones being used on a more global or maybe like traditional scale in the future that's outside of crypto natives?
Yeah. So I guess there's two parts to this. Like, one is, what is it being used for right now? And the second is, what will it be used for in the future? Mm-hmm. Right now, I think there's three things that crypto is used for. The first is stablecoins. And I think this is a very real use case, a very tangible use case. It has actual product market fit. And I think stablecoins being built on chain is better than any of the centralized alternatives. It allows for, like, for example, if you compare it to like the US banking system with like ACH, for example, or even wire transfers, it's just so much technologically better. Like, money moves a lot faster. International payments are, I mean, if you guys have tried sending money internationally, it's like even slower and clunkier. So payments, I think, are just better right now.
And it costs a lot too. I mean, I'm booking a trip and working with a foreign travel agent and like, well, let's not use your credit card because there's going to be exorbitant fees and all that stuff. So let's figure out a way. I'm like, can we just use crypto?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, if you use, say, for example, you're paying on the order of cents and it's going to take like less than a second. If you're using other, like if you're sending a wire transfer, several dollars, if not tens of dollars, and there's additional time tied to that as well. So I think payments have found product market fit on crypto, and we will start seeing that expanding because in the United States, it might not be as relevant. Like, if you already have these financial rails set up well in a country, then crypto might not be as useful. But if you're in a country where like the economy is kind of collapsing due to poor decisions made by the government, then having access to stablecoins is a complete game changer. So I think stablecoins are just going to continue having more and more traction going forward. Sorry, go ahead, Brendan.
No, I was going to agree. You know, I saw Chamath from the All In podcast saying the exact same thing. He was saying in 2025, he thinks one of the biggest changes or even just one of the biggest beneficiaries is going to be the stablecoin market. And he said all the same reasons that you just kind of listed off. And he said, like, look at the way that this can change the markets. And it's so easy. I know, you know, especially us here in the States, it's so easy to say, well, this might not affect me as much because I have a credit card and I have access to a tier one banking system at Chase or JP Morgan. When in reality, you know, we're in a really blessed position to do that, but not everyone's in that same boat. And so that's where the market share, the addressable market rather, really comes in.
Yeah. And even if you look at like we're kind of running out of, you know, sovereigns to buy, you know, U.S. debt. Right. But like all these stable coins are backed by U.S. debt. And so to spread and like everybody in theory all around the world would love to like trade in the U.S. dollar. And so it really is, you know, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal, an op-ed, it's actually by Paul Ryan, the former, like one of the former speaker of the house. And he was like, yeah, stable coins are how we could like stave off a U.S. debt crisis. That was like the title of the article. And so it's like crazy how much it's, you know, it's flipped on its head from like, hey, these are going to collapse the banking system, right? With Operation Chokepoint 2.0. And now these might like save the banking system. It's just crazy.
Yeah. 100%. Like, I think stablecoins are extremely synergistic to American international economic policy. Mm-hmm. Like, you want other people to be using the US dollar. You want that to be the default currency that is being used for exchange. I think recently a lot of countries have tried to push away from that. But even if the countries are pushing away from that, individual citizens from other places, like, they prefer the USD compared to their own local currencies. And I mean, as a result of that, if people are able to use stablecoins more, I think that just reinforces American hegemony. So I think from American policy standpoint, it's kind of a no-brainer. And that's why I think it's really exciting that like President Trump is as supportive of crypto as he is, because I think beyond just helping crypto get more adoption, I think it just ends up being beneficial for America as a whole. So I think stablecoins are a no-brainer kind of use case. I think the second use case that we're seeing right now is tied to the exchange of assets. And I think that is a very kind of, blockchains are really good systems for enabling parties that don't trust each other to do stuff in a cooperative way and having verifiability. And I think exchanges are one of the very clear use cases over there. Unfortunately, right now, I think a lot of the use cases for exchange is tied to speculation, where people are like creating meme coins for like NFTs or something, and that's what people are trading. I think in the long term, there will be more sophisticated types of assets that are being traded on chain. And I think once there's like clear crypto regulation that is defined, it'll become much easier to have things that are more sophisticated financial instruments that people are able to permissionlessly engage with on chain. Examples here would be like, let's say you're able to have like tokenized treasuries that people can make use of. First of all, it's just really easy to be able to transact with them on chain compared to logging into whatever your brokerage or bank is, buying it over there. And then there's like composability that it's enabled on chain as well. Like you can have this token that is collecting treasury yield used as collateral for something very easily. So I think there's these Legos that are enabled by crypto that you can like connect more easily that'll allow more sophisticated use cases. I think the third category right now is just all these unrelated types of use cases. So stuff like gaming, DPIN, AI agents, like all this stuff right now, I think is still very early. I think longer term, it'll start to get a lot more adoption. And I think flavors of all of this, they benefit a lot from blockchains. So we'll start seeing all of these benefiting from layer ones as well. One thing that I think is just fundamentally true is you need these blockchains to be performant. Mm-hmm. Because if you have a blockchain that is as a great VM, let's say Ethereum virtual machine, but with low throughput, which is exactly what Ethereum is right now, you can experiment well with it, but you cannot scale an application. You're never going to be able to get global scale, like Google type scale, for any application if you don't have good throughput. So I think the next generation of blockchains, which say spearheading, they're all going to be extremely high performance. And that's kind of a prerequisite for getting any kind of global adoption.
I love it. There's a lot of things we could dovetail off there, but I was just thinking, like, you know, from your vantage point as a founder of a layer one, you know, you're a builder. If you know, and we're going here into this next, 4-year period of a new administration, what would be kind of on your wish list? I don't know if you've thought of, as an L1 founder, here's the three things or the one thing that would make life easier, capital, access to capital and good, things, it'll be make it better. What would be on your wish list?
Yeah, so I think from a wish list standpoint, there's a few things that come to mind. And then from actual policy standpoint, I'm starting to see the writing on the wall that some of these things might actually come true. Mm. From a wish list standpoint, I think legitimacy is probably the biggest thing that would be helpful for crypto. Because right now, crypto has kind of been in this gray area where like there's been a lot of investor money going there. Some politicians have been supporting it, but it's also like Operation Choke Point, for example, and like how Gary Gensler from the SEC has been like taking enforcement or, yeah.
Yeah.
What's the term for it?
Regulation by enforcement.
Exactly. Yeah. Like that's not great. So I think it's been kind of this gray area. And like because of that, a lot of normal people are more skeptical of crypto as well. I think if the administration fully embraces crypto, it adds a lot more legitimacy to it. Mm-hmm. And I think that'll just lead to a lot more people that are both open to developing in the space, investing in the space, and then also making use of the primitives that get built. So legitimacy is probably the biggest thing. Mm-hmm. Second thing will be more investor capital. And then third thing will be more developer interest. Developer interest, like whenever any space is more legitimate, more people, basically like me, that have like these technical backgrounds that can build in the space, they come in and they start experimenting and playing around with it. And I think this will then result in more investors coming in to invest more money to support whatever these experiments are. In terms of actual policies that I've seen being discussed, the first thing is more clearly defined regulation around what is a crypto asset, what is not, and how should these crypto assets be treated. I think last year, the year before then, there was the FIT 21 bill that made its way through House, but not the Senate, if I recall. So something of that nature where like something that is actually able to get through Congress that better defines cryptocurrencies, I think that that would be a good starting point. Once there's like clear regulation around it, I think that incentivizes developers to come in, that incentivizes investors to come in as well, because it removes a lot of uncertainty. Another thing that I think would be honestly pretty incredible if it happened is President Trump has proposed the zero capital gains tax rate for cryptocurrencies that are launched by American companies. If something like that happens, I think crypto will quickly become the hottest sector in the United States.
That would be crazy.
It would be absolutely insane. I mean, I don't know if that'll happen or not, but yeah, if something like that happens, it'll just lead to so much more interest. And I think that'll just lead to a lot more kind of development in the space and people that are actually making use of the primitives as well.
I could definitely see radical policies being introduced. I mean, that would be certainly radical, but I did see earlier he's proposing to have the XRS, the External Revenue Service, in tandem with the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service. But the XRS is going to be basically, exercising, all these tariffs and basically import taxes on other people outside of the U.S. And maybe that would be able to bring the U.S. taxpayer's bill down at the end of the year. So, hey, I might be in support of that. I got to look into it a little bit more, but would definitely be in support as well of zero capital, 0% capital gains for American companies dealing in crypto. I mean, that'd be crazy.
It'd be a total game changer. And I guess just last thought over here is the Bitcoin reserve. I think this is something that has been floated a lot. I didn't mention it before, but yeah, I think that would also be a game changer. It'll obviously be good for legitimacy if the US is supporting Bitcoin in that way. I think it would also just indirectly benefit every other cryptocurrency by resulting in more people becoming interested in building and investing in this space as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree. You know, I've seen some stuff floating around here in recent days that, you know, he wants to act on that fairly fast. You know, there was talk yesterday on Twitter that, and that might be one of the first things he does in office, you know, maybe like a day one signing. So we'll have to wait and see. But I think a lot of people are looking at that. And we've already started to see other countries try to front run this. You know, I even saw that Meta, I think it was yesterday afternoon, was saying, hey, maybe we should explore the possibility of bringing Bitcoin onto our balance sheet. I think they have $72 billion in liquid assets. And they're saying, hey, you know, why not explore the possibility of having a MicroStrategy like approach with a fraction of that. And I think we're going to continue to see more companies look at that. And again, it's not going to be probably as extreme as MicroStrategy, where they have a near 100% allocation. But I think this realm of possibility where we see, you know, a 0.5%, 1%, 2%, 3% is something that will become increasingly popular, especially if we do get the reserve. But, you know, for the time being, there's a lot of things that will need to happen in order for us to get there. But it looks like it's becoming a reality. And I do want to circle back to this discussion that we were having earlier about layer one scalability, because a lot of these layer ones really are becoming so scalable. Do you think that do you think it's going to be enough to simply just be fast and cheap? Because there are projects out there who that's their whole spiel. And, you know, that's been their spiel for a while, is just saying, hey, we're fast, we're cheap, therefore you should use us. But now it seems like everything that's been created in the last couple of years, in the last cycle or so, well, everything's fast and cheap now. So do you think that that's going to be enough for projects moving forward, just saying, hey, we're fast and cheap? And if not, you know, what else is there beyond that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a fantastic question. The most candid answer over there is, well, I think the core answer to your question is no, it's not enough to be fast and cheap. I think the most candid answer over there is that there really are no technical differentiators in crypto. And what I mean by that is you can spend, let's say, hundreds of millions of dollars building really great technology. It has to be open source. If you're not open source, then I think you're not really going with the core ethos of crypto. And if you're open source, like, I mean, other people can just fork it and then try to build the same stuff that you're building. Right. And even if it's closed source, it's like some, let's say you put out a white paper about what kind of tech you're trying to build. I mean, other people are going to build that anyway. So I don't think there is any long-term technical differentiation in crypto. The only differentiation that you're able to get is tied to the ecosystem and the community. Like, it's basically the people that are tied to that project. They're the real differentiation. And I mean, I don't think that's like a controversial thing to say at all. Like, if you take Bitcoin and you try to fork the Bitcoin code base, run your own fork of Bitcoin, no one's going to be using it. Like, you're definitely not going to be able to get the same kind of scale that Bitcoin has been able to get. Yeah. That's because all the people that are tied to Bitcoin. And that kind of is why I'm really surprised by all these projects that are like trying to create alt VMs and try to get adoption with that. Because right now, what is very clear to me, and that's kind of the baseline for a lot of the decisions we made, is that all the mindshare is with the EVM right now in terms of execution environments. Like, that's what all crypto developers are basically building with right now. And it's really difficult to get crypto developers to move elsewhere. So it's, as a result, really hard to build an ecosystem, get killer applications, and like really get these people to support a new project if it's not making use of the EVM. That's why a lot of these like alt VM based chains, I don't really think that there's going to be as much adoption in the long term happening for them. The approach that I think you need to take is support the EVM, understand what's wrong with the EVM, and then make it 100x better. And if you're able to do that, that's how you can really differentiate yourself as a project in the long term. And that's exactly the approach that we've been taking with Say.
I think it's a great point. And, you know, earlier you were saying, kind of in lines with earlier, you were saying that when you first got started with Say, and when the mainnet launched, there was a little bit of a struggle kind of bringing builders in and retaining users and doing all that. And it's a hard thing to do. You know, I guess what helped you build and keep a community? Because, you know, fast forward now, we're now a couple of years in the future. And I saw an article the other day that was saying, hey, Say's crypto network just hit record highs in terms of user activity. So you've clearly found a workaround to arguably one of the hardest questions in crypto, which is taking market share from other layer ones, and then not only building it, but actually retaining it, because you all have been here for more than a market cycle now, and you all have not only survived it, but you've kind of thrived in it to these all-time records.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, when you phrase it that way, it seems like we've done a pretty good job. Well, the way that I think about Say right now is we're probably, if you wanted to like add different tiers to projects, yeah, like there could be S tier projects like Bitcoin, Ethereum, Solana. There could be like A tier projects, B tier projects, all the way down to like whatever CD tier. I think Say is kind of like middle of the pack right now, to be completely intellectually honest with you. And I think a lot of it has to do with the ecosystem that exists on the blockchain. In order for any blockchain to become massive, there needs to be killer applications that are built on top of it. And I think that's probably the biggest thing that we need to start seeing more of in Say. We need to start seeing more killer applications that are emerging on Say. Now, in terms of, I guess, what you were talking about before, like, how did Say kind of go against that trend? Like, initially, there was no community members. Like, people were not really that enthusiastic about Say after the token generation event. And how did it kind of grow from there? I think a lot of it was just based off the first principles approach that I described before. We realized, okay, reason no one is building right now is because we do not support the EVM. What is missing from the EVM? Well, we realized that the biggest limiting factor at the EVM is a lack of throughput. The throughput is the amount of transactions that you can really process per unit of time. And if you look at the, let's say, Ethereum L1, it's not really able to process that many transactions at any given time. Like, it's really slow. As a result of that, there's two things that happen. The first thing is that you end up having really high gas fees for users. Like, I don't know when the last time you guys played around on Ethereum L1 was, but like anything that you try to do, it costs on the order of dollars. And during periods of congestion, it can potentially cost hundreds of dollars to perform any meaningful action on chain.
Yeah.
You just price out most of the human population when it costs like $100 to do something on chain.
Yeah.
So I think gas fees being high is terrible user experience, and it just makes crypto completely inaccessible. The second thing is it restricts the developer design space. Like, if you're trying to build something in Web2 right now, you can build it however complex you want to. Let's look at Google. Google needs 100,000 transactions per second. And in Web2, there's not really any limitations around the kind of performance that you can get. If you're trying to build in crypto right now, Ethereum is only able to support 1.25 megagas per second, which translates into roughly 60 transactions a second. If you're trying to build in that 60 transaction per second kind of constraint, you really can't build super sophisticated applications with that. So what you end up having is you end up having developers take anti-patterns. So you start seeing things like automated market makers, which they don't exist in traditional finance because they're not capital efficient. And then instead, they exist in crypto now because they're able to fit the limitations of what the EVM is offering. So we think the biggest problem right now is lack of throughput. And that's why we started building Say V2, which is what went live in 2024. But Say V2 is the first parallelized EVM. And that's what really got the community excited. Like, we put out the announcement that that's what we're focused on building, and everything just went ballistic after that. Like, people became really, really excited. There started to be a lot of activity that happened on V1 as well as a result of that. So people started launching NFTs. They started launching meme coins. There started to be applications were getting built. And I think all of it just ties into people being excited about that vision. That ultimately ended up going live in July of 2024. So around 6 months ago from the time of this podcast recording. And it's been honestly incredible once we went live on mainnet with the parallelized EVM. We started seeing a ton of new applications getting built on Say that you really can't build on Ethereum L1. And we've also started seeing just more and more community members come in as a result of that excitement. And yeah, I mean, to your point around like Say has been around for like more than a cycle, I think it's really easy to have a strong community before any kind of token generation event for any project. Like, everyone's always bullish on any project that's pre-launch. The real test for a project is seeing what it's like around 18 months after the launch. 18 months is roughly when, like, I mean, the TG is gone. That's when a lot of unlocks and stuff have started as well. So that's when you can really see how much real community a project has. Mm-hmm. And that's right around where it's at right now. I think we're at the 17 and a half month mark since mainnet launch right now. And we have a very real community. And I'm just honestly very, very thankful for that.
Yeah, no, we're excited and we're seeing the growth. And, you know, before we let you go, we want to make sure that we sufficiently cover the latest upgrade that was, I believe, just unveiled in December. Correct me if I'm wrong on any of these facts. It's called the Giga upgrade. Can you walk us through this and what it means for Say's future and really what's going to be most affected on the Say network and what participants?
Absolutely. Can I share my screen for part of this?
Yeah, I believe you can.
And for all the listeners out there, make sure you check out the YouTube so that you can see the screen share.
Yes. If you are on Spotify or Apple Podcasts and you don't have access to the visuals, we apologize for this, but join us on YouTube.
Yeah, I will narrate it while we're talking about it. Cool. Okay, so we went live with V2 in July of last year, and we started seeing congestion even on V2. And that's when we realized that, okay, we're at a good spot right now, but I think we can become even better. And performance continues to be like the biggest area for improvement on the EVM more broadly. Mm-hmm. Even with where we're at with V2. So just for a little bit of comparison, there's a chart that I'm showing right now, and it shows the gas per second that different chains are supporting. So mental model for anyone that isn't familiar with gas, when you have a car, you put gas into it, the car moves and it consumes the gas. Going different lengths, you need to consume more gas. Like if you're going SF to, let's say, Oakland, that doesn't need as much gas as if you're going SF to Las Vegas. Similar concept with blockchains. Gas is like the amount of, basically the amount of compute that it takes to perform a transaction, and you get charged based off how much compute the network is going to need to process your transaction. So the more gas you have, the better. That means you're able to enable better performance. Ethereum L1 is able to process 1.25 megagas per second. Now, that roughly translates into 60 transactions you can process a second as the upper bound, which is not really that high. Most chains that are Ethereum L2s, they're OP stack L2s, they get somewhere between 2.5 to 5 megagas per second, according to this kind of this table that Paradigm, the VC firm, put together. And then on the upper end, you have chains like OPBNB, centralized sequencer, that are getting 100 megagas per second. That's kind of the upper bound for what you see on the industry. Say V2 is actually around 105 megagas per second. So it's a little bit better than OPBNB. And Say V2 is completely decentralized with a decentralized validator set. Now, the issue is this still isn't enough compute to really enable applications like Google to get built on chain. So that's why we went back to the drawing board. We're like, okay, we're currently at around 105 megagas per second. How do we go even higher than that? And what we realized is we need to rebuild every single part of the stack. So that's when we started working on Say Giga. We have completely rebuilt the execution client. We're changing the way that state works on Say with Say Giga. And we're also completely changing the way that consensus works. And with that, we're able to get, right now we're able to get 5 gigagas per second. So this is 50x more than anything you see on mainnet right now. This is in an internal devnet that we got working December 31st of 2024, so a couple of weeks ago. And the next step is now to start productionizing this. So decentralizing it, getting it working in a public devnet, and then eventually getting it live on mainnet.
Wow. It's going to be incredible. I mean, we're really excited about it. And I guess, yeah, the last question I had was just to mention earlier, you said, you know, intellectually honest, you think Say is middle of the pack. After the Giga upgrade, are we going to be top of the pack? Front of the pack?
We'll be able to enable entirely new types of applications to get built. And I think fundamentally, I would like to see Say become an S-tier project. The way that you get there is by getting killer applications built. Mm-hmm. In the case of Solana, for example, right now, there's Pump.fun, there's AI16Z as well. Other chains like, I mean, Polygon, I would say actually is, they don't have the best reputation in crypto, but I think they've actually been able to get killer apps like Polymarket built on it. Mm. You see like Virtuals, for example, on Base. So there needs to be an example of that on Say. And yeah, I mean, I think that's the biggest thing that Say Foundation, I know, is working towards from their side, just getting that first killer application built. Because once there's the first killer application, it becomes this very virtuous kind of loop where developers are then more excited to start building in that ecosystem, and it leads to more killer applications as a result.
Yeah, I mean, well, what this does is this opens up the opportunity doors for some of these projects that are building. They need something more scalable. They need something that can handle a lot more. I mean, you talked earlier about the scale that Google would need if they were to come into this. And there's projects that might be, you know, not on the same ambition level or requirements as Google, but they're still really high up there. And they're going to say, hey, we can't build here, we can't build there. And they need a very specific set in order for their project to even be functional at a base level. And so what you're doing here is you're opening up the doors to projects being more creative and doing things that we haven't done before. And I think that is what can inspire the next Polymarket, the next Pump.fun, the next, you know, you fill in the blank. You mentioned AI16Z. And, you know, hopefully we see that. And I think that if there's any time for that kind of stuff to get built, the two requirements are having the infrastructure in place to actually make it possible. And then the second one is having a regulatory environment that actually encourages instead of discourages that. And it looks like this year we're going to get both of those. So we're excited to see what happens. And, you know, when some of that stuff starts getting built, you're definitely going to have to keep us in the loop.
Yeah, that was very well said. And yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. Like, you need to have the core infrastructure. You need to have the right environment in place. In 2025, I mean, the writing is very much on the wall that that will be the year where we start seeing a lot of this come together.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Yeah, Brendan, very well said. Jay, thank you so much for your time and for joining us here at the Crypto 101 podcast. If people want to join the movement, get involved, get connected, where would you recommend that people head over? And we'll have that linked in the show notes.
Yeah, yeah. You could just follow Say Network on Twitter. They'll have all the announcements. And then you can also join the Discord. I think there's a lot of discussions happening there. You can go follow the link tree from the Say Twitter for that.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Jay. And we're excited to keep tabs on everything Say Network is developing. And we'll have you back on again soon. Take care.
All right. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. Instead, go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI and a watch and tab on any plan. Only on Verizon.
With new line on my plan. Service plan required for watch and tab. Additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.